Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush Friday interview edition with friend of the show and friend in real life, Mr. Paul Schneider.
Hello. I've got one thing to say to you, Chuck.
Oh, boy.
And it's this.
Looking for a De Niro quote?
It's this. I am like God and God like me. I am as large as God. He is as small as I. He cannot above me, nor I beneath him be. Silesius, 17th century.
Your accent is so much better because you are from North Carolina.
It's crazy how bad his is.
Yeah, here's the thing. We'll go ahead and talk about the accent in Cape Fear right off
Let's
the bat.
But
I do want to talk about something else before we even talk about the movie. But the accent is something that I had to get over and reckon with over the years. And now I actually like it for its sort of fun B-movie quality.
Yeah.
But it is by no means an authentic Southern accent.
No, I couldn't get over it at the first time I saw it. I was so like aggrieved as a Southerner. You know, I was like,
it's a big deal with us because it's such a hard accent to get right, and movies always way overdo it.
And not just that, but every Southern, you know, the default Southern character with a Southern accent in all media is an idiot.
Yes,
you know, he's a clown, and obviously. Us and other people like us have a problem with that.
Yeah, because we're Southern guys and we're fairly smart individuals.
Yeah, with low self-esteems, and we just want everybody to, you know, we want a place at the table.
How much time have you spent in your life defending the South?
Oh, man.
In conversation. You like me?
too much.
Yeah, it's a big thing because it's just like, no, we're not all dumb crackers.
Yeah.
We can be very progressive. We can be very intelligent.
And then I try to give like literary examples to back up myself, and I can't remember anything. I'm like Faulkner.
Right. Yeah, that's our guy.
And they're like, okay. And I'm like, you know, Onomatopoeia County, all the books. I might even say all the books.
Oh, so before we get going on Cape Fear in earnest, you just got finished shooting a motion picture in Louisiana, and I'm springing this on you, but is it something you can talk about, or you got to keep it under wraps?
Who fucking knows? I never get those emails, but it's another, you know, not unlike Cape Fear. Production for Blumhouse, and it kind of has this great pulpy kind of pulpy quality, you know. It's sort of an action family adventure, but in essence, just like this one, it's a family that, you know, has to deal with itself because of this sort of dangerous because of this dangerous, you know, incident that goes down.
Yeah, we don't want to give anything away. You already spoiled it for me privately.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, thanks a lot, man. I guess I don't need to see it now.
Yeah.
Of course I'm going to see it. But it sounds like a fun little thriller with some good twists and turns. A little Straw Dogs element to it, which is great. And it did, watching Cape Fear yesterday, I kept thinking, I was like, well, Schneider just did a movie that's not completely unlike this. Because there are some certain themes in Cape Fear that especially I get now more as a father and husband about the, whether it's right or wrong, the pressure a man might put on himself to be a protector, and guys like us probably feeling fairly incapable, like Nick Nolte was in this movie, of being a protector.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny how the decisions that Sam has made kind of strip him of his power, and the fact that he married Lee, this, you know, very beautiful, very intelligent woman, you know, she reminds him of this in these insidious sort of cutting ways all the way through.
Oh yeah.
The film. And one thing that I read was, you know, Scorsese was interested in making this, if if in the remake they pumped up the disintegration of the family and the deceit and the duplicitousness of the family and how much they tear each other apart. And in the DVD extras, the Blu-ray extras, they talked about how, you know, they used Bernard Herrmann's score.
Oh, man.
I know.
So effective.
That Elmer Bernstein conducted and arranged, and I met Elmer Bernstein in film school when he came to visit. But what they did is they used some of the most, the heaviest, most dramatic pieces of Herrmann's score in the family scenes, in the family sequences.
Yeah.
You know, not as Katie is coming after, coming after Sam with a pipe.
Uh-huh.
Or, is he breaking into the house? It was in these moments of, there's this great moment where Danny, Juliette Lewis, she says...
She's so goddamn good.
There's a whole movie crush on her. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the great sort of, I don't want to say kid performances, but like young adult.
Yeah.
Performances.
100%.
Because she fits right into the movie, but she's doing something else that's insane. You know, she's like an extremely well-trained actor and a completely non-actor all at the same time.
Yeah. What are you saying about her, though? I cut you off and you had a relevant point about her.
Oh, so I was noticing last night when I watched it again that, these juxtapositions between, what's happening in the character or the narrative.
Yeah.
And what happens in the camera.
Uh-huh.
So Danny says, I thought we were supposed to be relaxed now. And as the camera is like charging towards her at 100 miles an hour.
Uh-huh.
And there's that scene at the dinner table when Sam is saying, they hired Joe Don Baker as a private eye. And he's like, I think this guy's really going to work out. You know, he seems to be really enjoying it. And then the phone rings.
Right. And they all everyone jump out of their skin. It's one of my favorite moments.
Oh, man.
Danny, too, is the one. She's the one, the first one later in the movie at the climax in that last amazing sequence that we'll get to in depth later. But she's the first one that immediately has the instinct to try and manipulate his sexuality and his emotions.
Yeah.
Right off the bat, man. She's the first one that's like, I thought we had this connection. Or no. Yeah. Jessica Lange talks about the connection, but she's talking about reading Nexus.
Yeah, right. Yeah. She's like, I read that thing, let's connect on that.
Like, exactly. You know which part, and like right away, this girl is the one that's leading the charge while dad's tied up outside and Jessica Lange is at first just understandably completely freaked out.
And she uses language. It was something like, he says something like, did you read all of those parts? And she says, yeah, I read those parts, as if they're talking about something that Lee and Sam don't know about.
Yeah.
And it's like she, in this weird way, she like curls under his wing to sort of, to fool him, to try to find a chink in his armor. And of course, there's not one. It doesn't work. But it's funny. Both of those women are so crafty. I would say like cunning and crafty in the way that they are, trying to beat Max. And the way Sam goes about it is like caveman.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that as a pejorative. I mean, like, literally he's trying to smash his head with a rock.
Yeah, that's the only thing he knows to do, because he just makes a series after series of missteps and dealing and trying to handle this as the husband, whether it's
and handle it
to...
like as the lawyer.
Yeah. Exactly.
And maybe, maybe his journey in the story is to get back to be a fucking caveman and like sort of reclaim his monkey maleness, and like,
because
he certainly doesn't have that all the way through the movie,
No. And then, Sam or not Sam, can't remember Jessica Lange's character name. All of
Lee,
a sudden.
Lee.
Yeah. Lee. Oh man. That monologue at the end when she's chained, handcuffed to the thing and breaking down and saying the things that, you know, will you just do those things to me and not her? It's like, I love this movie in college. We watched it a lot and I saw it many, many times back then, but this is the first time I've seen it in many years. And certainly since I've been a father and maybe even a husband, but that shit wrecked me this time. Seeing that scene, Jessica Lange is so good. She should have been nominated. I'm so mad that she didn't. Juliette Lewis was, to her credit, which is great, nominated for an Oscar for supporting actress and lost to Mercedes Rule for Fisher King, which is another favorite performance of mine. So it's really hard to, and awards are all dumb anyway, but just the acting in this movie across the board is just amazing.
And she sort of, Jessica Lange sort of pathetically pulls at the strap, or not the strap, but like sort of the top of her shirt as this like, kind of like pathetic or luring, like, please do this with me, you know? And she kind of refers back to the time when she was putting on lipstick after she and Sam had made love, and she was looking out at this, you know, this blue screen, Max Cady.
Yeah.
But I wanna talk about one thing that I was blown away by this when I saw it a couple months ago, and this time too, is the speed of the narrative. And I wrote this down. I mean, I paused and rewound and I wrote this all down. So this is what we know in 6 minutes. Mm-hmm. We know about the existence of Cape Fear being a dreamy, dangerous place. Mm-hmm. We know that Max Cady has been released from prison and he's not an idiot because he read all his books.
Already we know read
him. Yeah, already read him.
Love it.
And we know that Danny relates more to Graciela, the housekeeper, than she does her mother or family.
Yeah.
We know that Lee is a graphic designer who loves her dog more than her daughter.
And or in my opinion, probably.
Yeah, definitely. And in my opinion, you know, the fact that her character is this artsy smoker, like to me, it also tells me that she doesn't want to be a wife or mother anymore.
Yeah.
And then we set up Sam as a lawyer who traffics in a world of privilege and favors because he gets the judge to push the alimony hearing of Fred Thompson's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, we get a taste of Cady in a small way terrorizing the family at the movie theater watching Problem Child. I mean, what
one of the great
fuck?
Scenes, that silhouette man and those... The character choices, the lighter, the big fat,
God,
the bikini lighter, that big, humongously fat cigar. There's so many, and I know De Niro is really, as are most actors, and I'd love to get your perspective on this too. When it comes to picking props and wardrobe and stuff like that, I know that he is meticulous and known for like trying on 50 jackets until he finds the right one. Like, what is that like for you as an actor when you get into that?
It really is. I mean, it really depends on whether or not you're Robert De Niro.
Like having the opportunity to, or
having the power to.
Okay.
Hopefully you have a director. Hopefully you have a director and a costume designer and a makeup department who's able to collaborate and kind of confident enough to collaborate.
Right.
And you know, sometimes you walk into a situation where they're, you know, they're hemming and hawing and they kind of want to give you a little bit of room, but they basically have all your clothes picked out.
Right.
And for me, I just want someone to say like, hey dude, you know, this is what I've got picked out. So can we talk about this? Instead of kind of like letting you, you know, kind of letting you go a little bit and coming up with ideas that, you know, they're going to shut the door on.
Right.
It's like just
like
fucking
placating you.
Yeah, just fucking tell me. You know, they had this idea that actors are this artsy fartsy lot who can't, you know, who are too sensitive and can't take, you know, can't take decisions or can't take
notes.
Can't take notes. But I just don't, you know, I don't feel that way. You know, if I feel like somebody's not going to collaborate, I just won't do their movie. But it's really hit or miss depending on who you're working with. And it really sucks because most of the time they cast you because they want to kind of dress you in the clothes of the movie they last saw you in.
Oh, interesting.
Because they cast you as that guy, right?
Right.
And so I end up wearing the same brown shoes every fucking movie I do.
Really?
Yeah. But then you have people like Jane Campion, and all of a sudden I'm like, you know, like in clothes I've never worn before, or
right, period, you know, piece, obviously.
Exactly. But who can see past, you know, the last character you played.
Does getting in that wardrobe, is that a real important thing to you, or is it just kind of part of everything?
If it's specific enough, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And if it's a period piece, shit, man, it does the acting for
everything.
You.
Yeah. That's amazing.
And apparently De Niro was like working out, you know, at night, and they shot all the stuff where he takes his shirt off towards the end of production so he could be as, you know,
max cut.
Yeah, lowest BMI or something.
Dude, I remember seeing this in the theater, or I think I probably did see it in the theater in college. And that first reveal of him in the cell.
Yeah.
When he's got that long slick back hair and his body is just chiseled out of fucking stone with those tattoos, man, and that back tattoo with that big cross. It's like intimidation overload right off the bat, and just so effective.
And
like it had to be that way.
And the and it was sort of like pre everyone has a tattoo.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And for like
shocking level of tattoos.
Yeah, yeah. And for two like ex youth group, you know, church youth group kids, all those Bible verses were like,
I know,
extra.
Like, what?
Yeah, they hit me and you probably harder, just like the Exorcist hit me and you harder, you know?
Yeah.
Like, whoa, like this is really not what my mom wants me to be near. yeah, he was crazy.
Let's talk a little bit about, and you know, we can jump all over the place, but I would like to talk a little bit about Scorsese's methods here and just what a wild movie he made with the changing the film stock to the negative.
Yeah, the negative.
And then these washes of color, and then from negative back to color, and those sequences where it would just sort of flow and drift back and forth.
And blue screen. And yeah. Diopters and jump cuts and unmotivated camera, and also
everything is in it. Like he really didn't hold anything back.
Well, I was thinking to myself, like, this is a movie that celebrates the fact that it's a movie. I mean, it's a pulpy, over-the-top, neo-noir cartoon. And if people watch it trying to, you know, watch like a super serious, you know, tight, you know, suspense thriller, well, this isn't that. It's not super serious, you know. It's sort of like,
yeah, it's not even reality.
No, tethered
almost. Like I have in here somewhere in my notes, it's a real movie.
Yeah,
it's got this heightened sense of reality, and it doesn't feel like real life. It feels just off. It feels like a bad dream.
Yeah, I mean, in the way that he, when they do the strip search scene, you have these like sort of like Nazi adjacent. Tattoos, you know, he's got these thunderbolts that are kind of like stormtrooper thunderbolts.
Yeah.
And then obviously the Bible, Old Testament tattoos. And then he takes off his pants and he's wearing like silk bikini briefs.
Yeah. The red leopard skin briefs.
Yeah,
that was such an interesting choice.
You know, like sometimes I talk to filmmakers or directors, you know, when we're making something, and I'm telling them like, guys, let's go for broke, you know, like, we can always take something out. We can't put anything in. Like, let's put everything in. And obviously for this one, they put everything in. You know, he celebrates the fact that it's a movie. And I mean, I look at it the same way that I look at Lawrence of Arabia. Like, to me, Lawrence of Arabia is a cartoon.
Uh-huh.
Like, if I see it as a cartoon, I can really enjoy it. If I'm picking through the, you know, if I've got Wikipedia open and I'm trying to fact check, you know, it's just it's not that.
I think the tone is set all over the place. Like, that opening sequence where it shows him in prison, getting released from prison, you know, he's got nobody coming for him. And that shot of him leaving the prison with that storm coming in the background, and he walks straight up to camera and basically... You know, that's the film school 101 thing where they're like, don't ever do that shot where you, it's such a tropey, like film student shot, but Scorsese did it. And you get the feeling it's just like, he's laying it all out there right there with that shot. It's like, just buckle up everyone. 'Cause this is a monster movie.
And it's a little bit like this film I love called A Christmas Tale, with Chiara Mastroianni and Catherine Deneuve and a whole bunch of other people. And the guy, Arnaud Desplechin, I don't know how to say his last name, but that's what I think it is. He right off the bat, he uses every filmic technique, mm-hmm. almost as if to completely sort of level you in terms of your expectations.
Yeah. Just so, set the table.
Yeah. So if I do everything within the first 5 minutes, then you can't sort of bitch or moan about anything.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like you could get up and leave right now if this isn't your bag.
Yeah, exactly.
Because this is what we're going to do here, everybody.
And the difference is that these guys, you know, Freddie Francis, obviously, but like these guys are doing this, you know, in film school, they were like, make sure all your camera movements are motivated, you know, yeah. make sure your lighting is natural, you know. Like uh-huh. Sam and Lee are having sex in that one scene, and there's like why are there fireworks?
I don't know, man. I thought the same thing. I never questioned it until last night or yesterday afternoon when I watched it. But man, it looks fucking awesome.
It That's does. I mean, I understand that it's July 4th or whatever, there's that scene, but it's not July 4th on that day.
Right.
I mean,
and where are they? They're living in, and I know they shot it in Florida, but this is just the setting of this film, the sort of low country of South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
I know you're from the Carolinas, and I'm sure that, and I know for a fact, because we talked about it, that whole sort of low country Outer Banksy vibe is so appealing and so evocative and can be so creepy. And it's such a great setting for a movie like this.
Totally. I mean, it's what, yeah, obviously it's what David Lynch locked onto in Blue Velvet.
Right.
But yeah, these guys are using all the tropes, but the fact that they know what they're doing, and obviously Thelma Schoonmaker.
Yeah. Legend.
Yeah. Like, I mean, these people are doing all the silly things, but it's just that they really know what they're doing. You know, they're doing all the silly things and they're the best at it. So they're kind of like, they know all the rules so they can break them kind of thing.
Yeah. But, she's the editor. For those of you who don't know, was Scorsese's editor for a long time and just a legend of the business, and really had her work cut out for her in this film. But also I imagine it was probably a lot of fun to edit this movie.
Totally. I mean, because it's a fable.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't, you know,
it's a big bad wolf.
Yeah, exactly. And exactly. And the scene with Juliette Lewis.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating now when we're living in sort of like the Me Too moment.
Mm-hmm.
How do you create those electric, upsetting, physical, sexual moments as an actor? I mean, obviously there are ways to do that, but when I was watching the scene again, where, I mean, the whole point of that scene, the reason why it's so electric is that obviously De Niro didn't tell Juliette Lewis he was going to put his thumb in her mouth. And
he didn't?
No.
Oh, man.
And she talks about that. I mean, first of all, that's one of the most, you know, it's like, for me, it's like 50% very disturbing. And also 50% sort of as an actor, 50% like, holy shit, how effective.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that whole scene it's one of the iconic scenes in movie history now, I think, is that drama department scene.
Mm-hmm.
She's so good in it. The way she plays that so innocently and so, like, the way, I even noticed the way she, after he kissed her, she was 18 at the time of filming, obviously still very creepy stuff to do, but they had to make
and
sure
looks
she was
young, looks of age, but, super young.
Yeah, but looked 15 or 16, sure. Which is what she played. The way that after he kissed her, oh God, it still just gives me the chills thinking about that because it was so fucking creepy. And he just bolts.
Mm-hmm.
And the way she played that
yeah.
unnerved high school, like kind of looked around like, did anyone just see that? Or what did I just do? And she ran out of there kind of upset, but kind of thrilled. It was all there, man. And just like face acting and the way she ran out of there.
Yeah, her shoes were probably like sort of pointed at each other. I think she pulled her her shirt down a little bit and it's like that's, you can't teach that.
No, and it was so instinctual.
And in the DVD extra, the DVD extras, Juliette Lewis talks about that being like one of her most satisfying acting experiences, you know?
I bet. Sure.
And she just was really into the electricity of it, you know? And she was into the, you know, without a netness of it, you know? And this yeah. idea that anything can happen, and it did. But you know, how do you create that in a world of rightfully in a world of consent, when we have to create moments right. of danger?
Yeah, I mean, it would certainly be a much more controversial scene to even put in a movie these days, and a modern scene like that. It was a different time, you know. The girl probably wouldn't put herself in that position, mm-mm. rightfully. But you know, he had set it up all the night before. He called her on the phone, established that bond, made her laugh a little bit, kind of was like, I'll be there for you because I know your parents, they don't get you. So it's all there. And I think that hits home of why Max Cady in this movie was so threatening, was that he didn't get out of prison and go to Sam's office and shoot him in the head.
Mm-mm.
He had this plan to terrorize this family.
Yeah.
And that's so much scarier than just getting out of jail and going and revenge killing your attorney.
And he, you know, I was really struck this time around when, you know, when they talked about, he has that line where he says to Sam, you're going to learn about loss. And I was thinking about this. So
yeah.
basically all three of them lose something.
Mm-hmm.
Danny is going to lose her ideal mother, which is Graciela.
Mm-hmm. Lee innocence.
Is going to lose her ideal friend, which is Benjamin, the dog.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam is going to lose his ideal wife, which is Elena Douglas, his, you know, his coworker. We meet them. They're both wearing white. They both are sexually attracted to each other. They're uh-huh. interested in the same things. They love racquetball. They love the law. Like,
well, and it's light. It's fun. It's right. not like this. His marriage at that point was this difficult thing where, you know, you learn later. I love the way they parse out the backstory too. Like, you can tell very early on that Lee has no respect for him in his work or as a man or in husband and father. But you really don't kind of get why until they parse it out later on in that great scene where you learn that he cheated years ago in mm-hmm. Atlanta, and that's why they left and that's why they moved. And I think it was really smart to hold on to that fact a little bit and just show her contempt that, you know, is there, but you're not quite sure why.
And she says, you know, and she says at the beginning, you know, in that first 6 minutes, she has, you know, she reveals these interesting kind of, you know, she reveals something about Sam where, you know, they're talking, you know, Danny is like, you should have punched that guy. And Lee says, yeah, Sam, you know how to fight dirty. You do it for a living.
Yeah, there's a lot of little jabs like that.
Yeah, and it's just the accumulation of those jabs are, it's just ridiculous. And the fact that he is so emasculated.
Yeah.
And because he's so emasculated, I think it's right that he uses the rock at the end. You know, it's right that he, you know, is that kind of primordial, you know, avenger at the end. Because all through the movie, he's such a joke, you know?
Yeah.
He's supposed to be this whip-smart lawyer, but every time he turns around, his house is being infiltrated. And mm-hmm. then when he goes on the attack, what happens? You know, Lee Heller, Max Cady hires Lee Heller.
Yeah.
He says, no, this is going to be a conflict of interest. He says, why? He's like, well, you know, Max Cady has employed me as his defense attorney. And he's like, what? Man. And every time, you know, like he goes along with Joe Don Baker and he hires a couple thugs to try to be, you know, and that goes straight to hell. And
that scene is great, man.
Cady beats the shit out of them.
Yeah, that scene is such a tense scene because Nulty, he's always just fucking up, man. He makes so many mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
He shouldn't have been there to see it happen. But he does. He wants to see him get beat down. And then, you know, Katie's superhuman at this point. He is a monster.
Mm-hmm.
Because these guys, three guys, beat him with chains and that steel bat over the head multiple times, and he's still coming back. And the one part of that scene that bothered me, that always bothered me, was when he kicks that can, makes the noise and freezes, and, you know, could you be there?
Mm-hmm.
And he approaches, and then the ending of that scene, I think there was no way out of it that made sense. So De Niro just goes, ah, fuck it. What's the matter if you do here, if you are here? And he walks away.
Right.
And that really bugged me, because, but then I started thinking last night, I was like, but how do you get out of that scene?
Yeah, you can't. I mean, like, if he came around the dumpster and it was revealed that Sam had sort of like scurried away, you know, sort of expertly scurried away.
That wouldn't make sense.
It wouldn't, but man, it would give, you know, it would really throw Sam's character a bone, you know? I don't know if that would be good or bad, but at that point he would feel like, but maybe, you know, maybe at that point of the movie, we need Sam to be as weak as possible, you know? He's chugging, he's borrowing Lee's cigarettes and he's chugging his wife's cigarettes at home.
Yeah,
you
know? And that's right.
He's being forced to duck under all the windows.
We're not supposed to stand up, Dad.
Right, exactly. And in fact, I was noticing last night, there's a scene, the first sort of, it's an early first long scene between Katie and Sam when Max is in his Mustang.
Yeah.
And he talks about, you know, Sam offers him money. He says, what about $10,000? And then Max does the math and realizes that it's like God. 10 bucks a day.
Oh, he just totally eviscerates him.
Right. And it's funny, through that whole scene, behind Sam's head is the word discount.
On that store?
There's a store. Yeah, there's like a banner for a store and it just says something, something discount.
Yeah.
But yeah.
It's no accidents.
No, not at all. These people, this Scorsese team, these people are not, you know, even if it's not conscious, these people are not making mistakes.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the only bone that Sam finally gets from Lee, from Jessica Lange, is that after they had been through everything and they were finally on the boat, she has not built him up at all or given him any breaks about anything, not that he deserved it, is when he says that he's going to go fishing the next day. And she goes, and it's a really great character moment. She says, you know, we got enough food to last us a week. Why are you going to do that? And then she kind of catches herself and she goes, because you know that she knows that he needs to catch the fish to provide for the family. Mm-hmm. Like he's a frontiersman. And she goes, well, I think that'd be really nice.
Right.
And that one little moment, man, she gives him in the whole fucking movie. And it's just so key to me that she felt the need to like, man, I've been beating this guy up. He has literally been beaten up over the course of this movie, and I've got to give him some shot of self-esteem, even if that's just, sure, husband, go catch the fish.
You know, and she, you know, like, he did betray her for sure, and obviously I'm not advocating infidelity, but the truth is, like, I think after a certain period of time, like, he doesn't deserve it in the sense that she's destroying herself in the process. You know?
Yeah, if you can't truly forgive, then you should get divorced.
Right, then she needs to get the fuck out. But she's, you know, she's ruining herself by staying there in this awful situation. And you're right, as far as character development goes, she needs to throw him that bone because we have to see them. There has to be a glimmer of hope at the end. And it's interesting because all these trappings of suburbia, all these trappings of, you know, professional success and, you know, all these, you know, friends, family, whomever, everything gets stripped away and they're just laying in the mud on the river's edge, you know, and the rain is sort of like completely fogging and drenched Sam's glasses. And they're kind of, you know, they're kind of like this family trio at the most, you know, in the most, you know, molecular sense.
Yeah.
And they have to start over. And I don't know if you saw the DVD extras, but Scorsese talks about that scene. There's a shot of Lee after she's been, you know, she and Danny have been sort of thrown from the boat and they swimmed. Over to the shore, the riverbank, and Sam and Max are kind of in the last throes of their manly battle. And once everything's sort of done, and Katie goes down with that piece of the boat, or we mm-hmm. think he goes down with the piece of the boat.
Yeah, that nice little shot.
Yeah. Well, she's left in the mud, and she's mm-hmm. she's there by herself, and in the shot, she picks herself up out of the mud.
Yeah.
And in the DVD extras, they were explaining that that was actually a reversed shot.
Oh, interesting.
In reality, she was laying herself down into the mud.
Mm-hmm.
But Scorsese wanted this, just the very slight sort of uncanny kind of
yeah.
Otherness to yeah, that yeah. to that shot. And I went and rewatched it, and I was like, man, these fucking guys.
It's so subtle, but like so cool.
They just, they, yeah. you know, and who knows if that was a choice. I'm always fascinated, like, is that a choice in pre-production? Is it a choice right. in production, or is it a choice in post?
I bet it's post.
It might be post.
That's just my guess.
Yeah. But I think, if you've got all the people firing on all the cylinders, these things don't have to be conscious. You know, they're just making decisions, and later on they will mean things. But in the moment, we don't know what they mean, but they're the right thing to do.
Yeah. There's also a moral question at the heart of this story that when I saw this in college 12 times, I never even thought about it, but there is a real moral question about a defense attorney bearing a report
mm-hmm.
of promiscuity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the whole central focus of this movie, is the fact that Max Cady went to prison for 14 years and maybe didn't have to, because there was a report that showed that the victim, his rape victim had been, I think had like at least two or three sexual partners in the last month. And it's, you know,
Fred Thompson.
Fred Thompson is the one. It's like, you buried the report.
I hate that. You buried the report.
Do you really?
Yes. I can't stand it. I feel like the reason why is because I feel like this fictional girl's promiscuity obviously has zero to do with whether or not she deserves to be raped.
Well, of course. And that's what Nick Nolte finally gets to say that at the end.
Right.
He's like, just because she was promiscuous doesn't mean she deserved what you did to her.
Right. But Fred Thompson can't, you know, he can't sort of at least say to him like, man, that was, you fucked up, but.
I get it. No, you're right. He comes down on a really hard moral judgment. and for, as a really moral question, there really is no question, obviously, except for the fact that you are entitled due process in this country and an attorney to represent your best interests, like no matter what. Like, he does go against that code. Rightfully so. I would have done the same thing.
Right.
But it is interesting to kind of pick out a little bit.
Yeah, it's funny how Max, as capable and intelligent and cunning as he is, he doesn't latch on to the idea that there's a gray area there.
Right.
He's so, you know, intensely focused on how he had been wronged. But he, mm-hmm. you know, of all the things he understands about human nature, he doesn't understand the part about human nature where he thinks, oh, wait a second, this is actually something that someone would do. But of course, that's because he was, he's on that side of he's on that side of the gun.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. It's such a diabolical plan, too, that De Niro has. It's, you know, he starts with the dog. And then he moves on to the mistress in one of the most brutal assault scenes in movie history.
Yeah.
Hard to watch.
Very.
And Ileana Douglas is so great. I've always been such a big fan of hers.
Yep.
And she's really great in this movie. But the scene in the bar beforehand is just like panic-inducing almost, because you know what he is. She doesn't know what he is. And she's drinking at the bar and you see it coming. And it's a tough scene to watch. But he moves to the mistress, then to the daughter, then to the wife, and then ultimately to Nolte is his. He's going to be the final guy because he wants him to see all this other shit happening,
right? And he gets, you know, he gets in there in such. I mean, it's funny that there's, you know, underneath all this wild sort of neon colored, bright, poppy, you know, the costume choices are so corny and ridiculous. You know, his De Niro's stupid mirrored glasses and his stupid white little Danish little captain's hat. Like, these are ridiculous things on the top. And then below, it's a pretty brilliant, you know, efficient script where, you know, he gets, you know, he gets through to Lee by explaining how Sam had betrayed them both. Mm-hmm. And so they're both wrong. They're both on this side of Sam. And obviously, he locks into Juliet Lewis's, you know, her distance that she feels and the fact that she feels so misunderstood by her family.
Mm-hmm.
And even when they're trying to, you know, even when Sam is trying to relate, to protect, to, you know, to protect Danny, there's that scene that just kills me. He goes into her room and she's, I think she might be talking on the phone. She hangs up the phone and she's wearing these like short, actually she's wearing her underwear. She's in her underwear. Yeah.
He tells her to put clothes
on,
right?
Yeah, he says, come on, you know, you're not a kid anymore. And she's popping gum and being a teenager, whatever. Mm-hmm. And he goes in there and he asks her, well, I can't remember the reason he went in the first place, but they get onto the topic of, you know, did he touch you?
Yeah.
And she kind of brushes him off and he comes closer and he's like, no, did he touch you? And mm-hmm. and it sort of builds to the point where Sam has got his hands on her mouth.
Yeah.
And he's crushing her head into the bedboard, mm-hmm. or the headboard of the bed, and then he finds himself and he kind of backs up a little bit. I think he tries to like fix her hair maybe, and he's like, sorry, so you know, and he leaves the room, and then she screams like, get out of here, and this family like it just keeps on stepping in shit. These people, you know, Sam especially, he just can't get anything right.
Well, yeah, because he treats her like she's dumb and a kid. And because there's that one scene where he and Lee start to really go at it and he sees Danny walk up the stairs and he's like, oh, everything's fine, honey.
Right.
And she's, you know, that's the worst parent move. Because kids fucking know, man. I grew up in a house with parents who were in a 25-year fight. And like, kids aren't stupid. And to have parents be like, oh, everything's okay. That's just it makes it all worse.
That's for them.
That's for them. And that's when De Niro sweeps in and gives her agency and treats her as an adult. And that's how he charms her to begin with on that first, the phone call. And then when he's hanging upside down like a vampire
bat. Yes. Yeah. I noticed so that great. This time.
Like a vampire bat. It was such a cool decision to put him in those gravity boots or whatever.
And he, you know, in the Ileana Douglas scene, and I wonder, was Scorsese dating Ileana Douglas at the time?
They either were dating at the time or they started dating after this.
Right.
It was right around that time, though, I think.
Because, you know, in that scene at the bar, for some reason, it's super creepy that Max is always drinking water.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like Evian.
He's buying her drinks.
Yeah. He's like the Evian in the Mustang and everything.
But well, because he's so disciplined.
Yeah.
He's got the discipline to read those, teach himself to read and to do the 10,000 sit-ups a day and to not drink and to always be clear-headed. I also think that was a really clever setup with that he bites her cheek in that brutal scene. Because that comes back later. That's partially what makes the scene with Juliette Lewis so unnerving when he starts kissing her. And I remember the first time I saw it, I was like, he's going to bite her tongue off.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is so effective. And he doesn't, which is a great little filmmaker trick to build up something that doesn't really happen.
And in both of those scenes, not in the biting Ileana's face scene, which I think it's something they weren't going to do. And they threw it in there. And that was, you know, that's something that I'm always pushing on directors. I'm like, guys, you know, like this is... Like this is, you know, we don't have $100 million. Let's throw everything at this, you know, like the only thing we have is the ability to make this script and do things narratively that no one's ever seen. We don't have David Fincher money to make this, and Emmanuel Lubezki kind of, visual masterpiece. So you've got to throw that silly shit in there. And if it doesn't work, then take it out. But you were asking about the costume and the hair and makeup choices. And in the scene with Ileana at the bar, and also in the scene, the big bad wolf scene in the school auditorium, De Niro looks really good.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's kind of feathered his hair back. His hair looks
amazing.
Yeah,
it's not greased back.
Oh,
it's dry.
No, yeah. And he's, I don't know what he's, gotten a bit of an extra tan, but he's really handsome in those scenes.
Yeah.
And that, that kind of bait and switch where he says, I actually was, I was in a Georgia State Penitentiary.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh shit, here.
The
jig is up. And he talks about an anti-nuclear power plant.
Oh, man.
Protest.
Yeah, he saved a little old lady, basically, who got shoved around by a cop.
Yeah, and so he popped him one, God. And they gave him 3 years.
Yeah, so, brutally manipulative and brilliant.
And
as soon as that happened, you're like, oh, shit, man.
Yeah, and as soon as that happens, Ileana's like, I'm drinking sea breezes. I hope you can afford them.
Yeah.
And she's in,
Yeah, the one thing that I wondered about yesterday that I had never considered is what a big risk that was for him. Because he, by all intents and purposes, should have been back in prison for a very long time after that brutal assault. And he took a really big risk on her, banking on her not saying anything. And Nolte kind of mentions it later. Like, I think he knew that she knew the system and stuff, but...
Yeah.
Still a very, very big risk that he took by going that far.
They could have fixed that, they could have fixed that a little bit by saying, he knew that she wasn't going to testify, that she was going to, that she was going to get on the stand and get grilled. And
right.
Lee could say, I don't know what her response would be. And then Sam's response could be, well, he's also a fucking monster who likes to rape, it's, Katie is cold and calculating and pays for everyone's lunch when no one knows he's there.
Right.
But also he's a guy who, raped and assaulted people. And, regardless of however many crunches he does every day, there's still part of him that's that big bad wolf. That's that, I think you're right. Like in the story, in the script, it's a little bit flimsy, I guess, when he says, oh, he took this big risk because he absolutely knew that she wasn't going to testify. I mean,
right?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's a little bit flimsy right there, but but sort of beyond the script, in me thinking about him, I like the fact that he's, he just can't help himself.
He is a monster. And you mentioned the buying people, they're paying for their dinners and stuff. It reminds me of that scene with Joe Don Baker where he was tailing him and he paid for his lunch or whatever. And what a great scene that was, because Joe Don Baker, I mean, this is such a movie about the male identity and masculinity and what that must mean, because Nolte is trying to be this protector. He thinks he needs a gun. He doesn't even know he's so ill-equipped to protect his family, and he knows it. Max Cady is the quote unquote real man. Joe Don Baker is a real man, and he's always got it figured out. That scene with he and Cady after that lunch is so great, where he's trying to tough guy him, and Katie's just like, fuck you, man.
Yeah.
He's like, you don't know who you're talking to, asshole.
And he says something like, were you a cop? Or maybe you couldn't hack it as a cop.
That's the line. That's where he completely fucking cuts his Achilles.
And it's funny, Joe Don Baker is all, ever since The Living Daylights, I've always seen I've seen that actor as like somebody who's big and blustery, but he's not going to win. Essentially, he's not capable. I mean, we haven't even talked about the greatest sequence, that concludes with Sam slipping in, Graciela's blood.
So, all right, let me start at the beginning there then, because that scene's ties into what I was going to say about Joe Don Baker is he always thinks he's got it figured out.
Right.
At first, it's, we can hire a couple of guys. You won't be hearing from him anymore after this. They're also ill-equipped to deal with this monster. And then when he starts out that sequence where they're doing the overnight, Sam fakes like he's going out of town, so the house is empty, supposedly. Or not empty, but he's not there. And he ties that fucking teddy bear up with the fishing line.
Perfect.
Yeah, and he's like, I don't know if the Holy Ghost is trying to get in here. I got my little six-shooter, you know, snub-nosed cop special.
They use the teddy bear. Essentially, they're strangling the teddy bear with monofilament line.
Oh, I didn't even really ever think about that.
And, you know, that foreshadows the piano wire.
Yeah. But he just thinks he's got it all under control.
Totally.
Like, every man in this movie thinks they have it all under control. And Katie's really the only one with any control ever. And, it culminates. And, you know, they set up, you, of course, after seeing this multiple times, and you see the housekeeper earlier on, you're like, it looks a lot like De Niro from behind.
Yeah. You know what's funny, Chuck? I realized when I was watching this, I mean, I watched it again last night, but Graciela is the second character that we see on film.
Oh, at the very beginning?
Yep. Right when Katie walks into the camera in that kind of cheeseball film school thing that they tell you not to do, but it's perfect.
Yeah.
You know, there's a scene where we go and we establish the outside of, I might not have this sort of visually verbatim, but we establish the outside of the Bowden house, and then a car pulls up and there's actually a shot on the driveway, and Graciela's foot steps into the shot.
Uh-huh.
And the camera, I can't remember, it either tilts up, I think it booms up to her face as she looks up at the house, and then Danny comes out and says, ¿Cómo está?
Yeah.
But Graciela looks up at the house a couple beats too long, and the camera stays on her a couple beats too long, almost as if to say that this is going to be a huge character in this movie, kind of she is, but not really. And I just thought, man, that's really ballsy to put a lot of weight on this character. And obviously he's trying to really weight this, you know, he's trying to really heighten the stakes. So you've got this character in a single, and not just a single, but a single that booms up.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got Benjamin, a single of the dog underneath Lee's drafting table.
Uh-huh.
And then it's not exactly a single, but when we meet Ileana Douglas, it's in that really kind of handheld, crazy, you know, fast cutting.
The racquetball?
Right.
Yeah.
And so we see all these characters in, you know, isolated singles. You know, like this movie is saying, like, you watch these people. You know, watch these two people and this dog. And obviously, we don't know this at the time, but they're sacrificial lambs.
Yeah, all three of them.
And each person is, I mean, if you think about it, I'm just thinking about this now. Like, I'm thinking about the reaction of Danny when Graciela dies. She freaks the fuck out.
Yeah.
And Lee's reaction to Benjamin dying, and she and Bowden, Sam says, well, I told you not to let him out. And she says, I didn't fucking let him out.
Yeah,
and
she's already in the house.
Yeah, she freaks out about that. I mean, again, all rightfully, all appropriately. And then, of course, Sam, it's funny, his reaction to Ileana Douglas's rape and assault is, you know, I mean, obviously, I think he has a lot to, you know, I think he feels very deeply about her being hurt. But, you know, we see each character's kind of silent response to the thing they truly wanted being, you know, obliterated.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And obviously, you know, he's hanging on. He's establishing the, was it Graciana?
Graciela.
Graciela. He's establishing her early on, too, just because that pays off later.
So, I mean,
when De Niro's dressed up as her. So you really got to at least know what she looks like from behind and what her hair looks like and what she's dressed like. And that's one of the great reveals, man, in movie history. When she turns around and it's him, it's just, I got chills in my arms now thinking about it. And I've seen the movie a dozen times and it gets me every single time. And the setup with the piano wire being gone, it's all just expertly like puzzled together.
And to me, it's better than the face skin reveal of Silence of the Lambs.
Oh God, that's so good too, though.
You know, I mean, for me, I'll take, I think it's because of the hair, but we should tell the listeners that, so Joe Don Baker has this big plan to absolutely catch, you know, catch Max Cady. And the whole plan is that they're going to use the family as bait to lure Cady in. So Joe Don Baker, in his kind of like blustery, overconfident way, strings a fishing line all over the doors and windows because he thinks he's going to, you know, he's going to see the bear move because the line, the fishing line is wrapped around the bear's neck. So he sits there all night drinking his, you know, scotch and Pepto-Bismol mixture, holding his gun. And the whole idea about the scene is that he goes in the kitchen. He's, you know, we see Graciela in her pink, you know, maid's outfit and her black hair. He says something to Graciela. And of course, Graciela turns around and it's, in, you know, it's revealed to be Bob De Niro or Max Cady. And of course he strangles the fucking shit out of Joe Don Baker with the piano wire.
Yeah.
And Joe Don Baker falls to the floor. Max
Well,
Cady,
the gun goes off. He shoots himself.
Oh yeah. 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 That's right. Yeah. Cause
that's where all the blood came from.
Right. And De Niro kind of guides the, in the struggle, he kind of guides the gun.
Yeah. In, back to him.
Yeah. In Joe Don Baker's direction. And then, of course, the Bowdens wake up and they find, you know, like Max Cady's gone. They find Joe Don Baker. They find Graciela. And in the melee of trying to call the cops or call the ambulance or whatever, Sam slips and falls on, you know, on the blood, in this pool of blood that's covering the linoleum.
One of the great decisions in any movie ever,
right,
was to not just have that reveal and be, and that be what the scene is, but to have him slip in the blood and then Lee come over trying to help him out and falling all over in the blood. It's a very kind of goofy slapstick thing, but it's so visceral and like hard to watch because you're just, they're just covered in this fresh warm blood. Now all of a sudden it turns into a fucking horror show.
It does. And this is the, I think this is the power of the auteur director. These days, everything is so watered down because we have to, you know, movies are so expensive where you have to reach like the biggest, broadest fan base. We have to reach, you know, ages 12 through 50, and we can't be specific and we can't be dangerous or evocative or well, we can't take chances. And that right there is an insane chance, you know?
Yeah.
I just saw, you know, another round last night, the Mads Mikkelsen that won the Oscar.
Oh, yeah. Is that good?
Oh, man. I had the best time watching it. I thought it was amazing.
Can't
wait. Yeah, and then obviously Thomas Vinterberg is another auteur. He's saying, no, I'm going to do this. And the choices are really specific, and either you like it or you don't. And the ability in movies these days to either like something or not, is getting, you know, it's sort of getting farther, and it's rarer these days. And most of the time the response is, eh, but I, you know, I don't want, eh, I want, I hated it or I loved it. But so many films these days are just kind of, they're trying to succeed by not failing.
Right.
And
by not offending or not failing.
Not offending, not failing, you know, I see on movie sets all the time, you know, certain producers that are not good producers, they're so concerned that something will be too weird or somebody won't understand something, or we need to over explain something, or the dialogue needs to be, you know, too much exposition.
It's the worst.
And the thing, once you do that, you lose all the moments that you and I are talking about.
Yeah. I mean, that blood slip scene, I mean, this is a movie made up of, very iconic images and disturbing images that you're looking at with your eyes. I mean, there's a lot of disturbing themes, of course, and themes and lines here and there, but it's really some of these images that really are what stick with you. And to me, there's that one, and the other one that really gets me every time is that reveal that he's fucking strapped underneath that Jeep Cherokee.
Oh, my God.
Such a great reveal, because they're finally... Nolte finally makes one good decision.
Right.
Which is to get on that houseboat and go out on the river, which is, it's a creepy looking place. And that's the whole deal with the Cape Fear River. And she talks about that, you know, and everything like that. And it's called Cape Fear. But you're ostensibly safe out on a boat on the water because there's nothing around you. You can see everything. He can't get to you there, but he's strapped underneath that Cherokee. And it's just one of the great reveals.
And this is when, and it really is. And this is when, Bowden, Sam is really trying to take some forward, you know, like make some forward movement.
Force majeure.
Yeah.
He's all bets are off.
Yeah, exactly. And that was another thing, you know, there was some discussion on set about whether or not that would be possible. And you can tell in the shot that they lifted the Jeep Cherokee a little bit.
They lifted the suspension.
But,
get him some more clearance.
Yeah. And apparently they tried it with a stuntman and it worked. And then they went for it. But like that part, you know, that reveal, the blood, slipping in the blood, you know, biting half of Ileana Douglas's face off and sticking his thumb in Juliette Lewis's mouth. Yeah. These are all the images. Yeah, these are all beats in the script that, in my experience, I've seen nervous directors and nervous producers want to, think very hard about maybe losing.
Yeah.
It's to this or to that or to this or somebody would be offended.
That must be frustrating.
Oh, it's so frustrating, especially when, you know, would Cape Fear still be a great movie without those things? It would, except, except it's like a meal, you know, a meal that you and I both love. Slowly, great ingredients are being taken out of this gorgeous meal that we're ready to eat, you know, this filmic meal. And after a while, you lose those images and those ingredients, and the specificity of these movies are lost in the process.
Yeah, I mean, if you think of anyone who loves this movie, if you said, name the first five things that you think of in Cape Fear, the first five images, it will be the thumb in the mouth.
Yeah.
Probably slipping in blood. Maybe the reveal of hanging underneath the car. But, you know, those are the moments that, like, yeah, you can't lose that shit.
Yeah, and if they truly remember the movie you're talking about, if they truly remember Cape Fear, they will say exactly the thumb in the mouth.
As the number one.
Yeah, yeah. They, like that, to me, that's like the takeaway. And then obviously you remember other things, but like that's...
Maybe the face biting.
That really?
I mean, that's so disturbing. And it was so over the top. The way he spits it out too.
Right.
It was, but yeah, I would say the thumb in the mouth. That's the most disturbing moment in the movie because there's so much tension there. You have no idea what he's got up his sleeves.
And further down the line is Max Cady, his burned and deformed face on the houseboat. And one thing I love about Danny's character is that Danny is a deadbeat. She's a pot smoker. Like she's not, I think I started watching the original and didn't like it and stopped it.
And I've never seen it.
Yeah. The kid in that movie is sort of like kind of the stock character of like, you know, the good kid. Uh-huh. And Danny's such a deadbeat. You know, she smokes pot. She's kind of dumb. Like her mom asks her what, you know, the girls in the parade who are dancing by with their, swinging their batons and everything else. Is that what they're called? Those batons you swing between your fingers?
Yeah, batons.
Batons, right, okay.
The drill team or whatever.
Right, right. Like silver, a silver shaft and two white balls on the end.
It's a baton.
Yeah, right.
I think so. It just didn't sound right?
I don't know. I'm going to have to, I need to get up on all this daughter shit.
Yeah.
But you know, Lee says to Danny, "Oh, Danny, you could have done that. Why didn't you go out and try out for that?" And she goes, "Oh, I don't know."
Yeah.
And she's got nothing. You know, she's got nothing. She goes to this drama class. She doesn't know what she's doing. You know.
Yeah.
She's constantly like,
good point.
You know, complaining to her friend on the phone because she's in this, you know, whirlwind of a shitty family life. But then in the end, in my opinion, the most the most sort of exacting, violent, capable moment of attack, it comes from her.
Yeah.
She's the one that slips the you know, the lighter fluid in her skirt or something, wherever she hides it. And, oh, actually, when she's locked in that little,
the first thing she does is light a match and starts looking around.
Yep.
She picks up that screwdriver or whatever, and it's like, thumbs it. It's like, no, it's too dull, throws that away, and then gets that Ronson lighter fluid and stuffs it in the front of her shorts. And, like I said, she's the one from the beginning that starts to try and manipulate him. She's thinking faster than anyone else on that boat.
Anyone else.
And, you know, of course, he lights that cigar. That's, you know, you don't question stuff like that in a movie.
No.
It's like, well, what if he never lit that cigar? It's like, well, he did. Yeah. So that's all that matters. And yet another great payoff, because he does it so many times in the movie. And man, when she lights him on fire and he jumps out there, like, no part of you seeing that movie thinks that that's the end of the movie.
No.
Like, you know that that's not going to be it. And you're right. When he comes back and his face and his hairline is receded by several inches,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's got a lot more forehead in that scene because his hair has been singed back.
And it's a so wide creepy. Shot, you know, Danny's on the table in the boat.
Yeah.
And Katie's leaning up against the sink. And then she squirts the lighter fluid across the room. He goes up in flame. And if I'm not mistaken, Danny says, I got him. And you're right. Like, here's this kid who's basically sort of a dullard the entire movie. She's kind of like roaming around, sort of kind of being upset and sort of being slow.
Yeah.
And here,
she's a teenager.
Yeah, here she is on this, you know, in this one moment of crisis. And she's like, she turns into the ninja.
Yeah. And that's when the movie, like, from that point on, this is a movie that escalates and escalates and escalates toward like genre style stuff. And then when he comes back on that boat, that face, it is all bets are off. It is a full on horror freak show.
Right.
For the last 8 minutes or whatever is left in the movie.
While the storm rages outside.
Yeah, man.
And there's this, when she talks about Cape Fear in, you know, there's that, you know, Juliette Lewis's, Danny is looking straight at the camera at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, she talks about Cape Fear. And at the end, it pays off because it bookends where she's talking in front of the class. But we see Cape Fear as this, like, this place of dread.
Yeah.
Because she talks about it. And then it's gone. We don't know anything about Cape Fear. We don't hear about it. We don't know anything about it until the end. And it's back again. You know, Danny is, you know, she definitely becomes the ninja in that scene. Lee tries to kind of, you know,
misdirect him.
Yeah, misdirect him with her sexual prowess or whatever. Mm-hmm. And of course, Sam wants to, you know, take the rock and bash his head in. And it should be noted that Sam doesn't hit his head.
No.
But, you know, the tide sort of drags Katie's body out right as the rock comes down and he misses.
Mm-hmm.
But I have always had a problem with the speaking in tongues.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, all right, hold on a second. Let's I want to get there. That's at the very end. Let's talk about that ridiculous and ridiculously great in every way sequence where the boat caves in on itself.
Oh, yeah.
It hits that rock.
Oh, the miniatures are horrible.
It's amazing. This is sort of a B-movie in some ways and a sort of an homage to Hitchcock and B-movies and movies. So I don't think it was trying to be like the most realistic thing. But, I mean, I still think that part looks amazing.
It's a C-movie. When they get into the miniatures, it's a C-movie. And I love it.
But when Katie gets back on finally at the end and he's putting Sam on trial and breaking the fourth wall and looking at the camera and, you know, acting as if the camera is the judge and that he is the litigator, that's when the movie is just goes to 11.
It's
just off the rails crazy at that point. And it culminates in the speaking in tongues, I think. I think it was all BC movie build up to that moment. And you still have a problem with it?
I mean, look, the good thing that those guys do is that they set everything up at the beginning. And you know, they give you a movie right in the first 6 minutes. I mean, look, they give in the first 6 minutes, they give you a lighter of a girl's boobs, you know, like the lighter that Katie uses to light his, you know, it's like a naked chick lighter, you know, from a gas station in 1985. Right. It's ridiculous. So, you know, I mean, once they do that, they can go anywhere they want. And definitely by the time they get into the, you know, the kind of the fake trial a scene, you know, script-wise, you know, all the other stuff that's going bananas, you know, with your production design and your editing and your this athletic camera.
Running the film backwards and forwards, all that stuff. It's crazy.
By that time, we were already there. So the table has already been set for what becomes, in my mind, the kind of the most extreme script moment. Which is the fucking, which is this crazy trial. Oh man. And when he grabs Sam by the back of the hair and, you know, and when Sam is handcuffed behind his, you know, his hands are handcuffed behind his back and he grabs him by the back of the hair and pulls him through that window. And Nick Nolte just bounces on all this teak, you know, this like teak boat furniture. I just thought, oh my God, man. These guys are, but again, you know, the miniatures which they shot in England, they're terrible. They look terrible, and
I mean, it's fun though.
That's and I think the fact that they're embracing this artificiality, those are the movies I love. I love the Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover.
Love it.
You know, I love all the stuff that is. You know, I'm not interested in, you know, I'm not always interested in realism. I don't want to look out my window and see a movie. I want to like look into somebody's imagination and see that movie.
Yeah. It is interesting though, in that trial scene, as kind of over the top as it is, that's where you kind of get that key moment where Nolte finally says it. Yes, I buried the report.
Yeah, right.
Because, I mean, that's where it's finally laid out there at the very, very end of the movie. And you were my lawyer. You were supposed to represent me.
Yeah, right.
Just because she was promiscuous doesn't mean she deserved to be raped. I mean, that's it. That's that moral quandary in a nutshell at the very end. And, you know, that's just prior to the boat implosion. It also leads to the funny fight scene on the beach at the end when they're just slugging the shit out of each other.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite lines still is... I believe you're well within 500 yards, counselor.
I mean,
it's so over the top.
If you go back and you can't even, I mean, half of Katie's dialogue you can't understand because of his accent, but his stuff with Joe Don Baker is, well, you've got me shaking all over. And there's when Sam comes across, he sort of bolts across the parade and grabs Katie because Katie's looking at his wife. You know, at one point, Katie says, in his defense, he said, "I ain't pranking on you. Mm-hmm. I'm not pranking on you. Like, what the fuck?" And
that's
when
some hillbilly shit.
Yeah, and when Sam is going nuts on this guy, on Katie. There's this shot that I'll always remember. I don't know why, it's just buried in my consciousness. But there's a shot of this kid on the float, and they're recreating.
The Army kid.
Yeah, they're recreating the
Iwo Jima.
Yeah,
scene.
Exactly. So they're recreating the time life photograph of Iwo Jima, and this one kid, you know, who's kind of. He's meant to be staying completely still as the parade moves by. Sam is going so nuts and so, you know, he's going so nuts there. This kid breaks his Iwo Jima character and just looks down at him
weird shot.
It is. It's like, what, why are we on this kid? You know,
I remember that shot too. Every time I see that movie, I'm like, why did he insert that shot? It's a really interesting thing to leave in there.
Yeah.
And there's that great part too, where De Niro's like, well, watch my arm. It might be broken.
Yeah.
It's like Sam has backfired again. Like everything he does just turns to shit. And the roles are constantly being reversed where he's the bad guy.
Completely. And I think, I need to, I need to wrap it up because my wife needs to leave the house. But I want to say that it's those moments of those out of context moments, those moments where we don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
Those are a lot of the moments that we remember forever. And this and this constant push of, you know, that we're living in this like numbers world, you know, we're living in a world of algorithms make sense and sort of A plus B equals C world. And mm-hmm. the truth is it's those moments of, you know, complete randomness, you know, those moments that we truly do have no idea why they left that shot of that kid in there. I mean, you know, plenty of people saw the edit and they were like, what's the deal there?
Yeah,
people are going to be confused. Why could be, well, that's a bad thing. And what I say to them is like, why is confusion a bad thing? This is a B movie, neo-noir, crazy, big, bad wolf movie. Like we should all be confused a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I think we did it, dude.
You think?
Yeah. I mean, I only had one or two more points. The weird stigmata, Christ figure stigmata at the end.
Yeah.
That he washes his hands away. I'm not sure how to unpack that.
Oh, that's,
and it also, it also bugged me that he was washing his hands instead of immediately running and looking for his wife and daughter.
Right, right.
Well, yesterday I was like,
baby steps.
What the fuck is he doing?
Baby steps.
Yeah. Sam will get there.
Yeah.
And I am glad they didn't show them, you know, a worse, a lesser director would have, the last shot of the movie would have been the three of them living together with a new puppy that looks just like the old dog.
Mm-hmm.
And living happily ever after somewhere. But he didn't do that. That's the tropey ending. He ended with Juliette Lewis with that great sort of bookended monologue about choosing life. And the film goes negative again, and this is like, we're out. And she even says the end, I think, right? The fairy tale is over.
Yeah, and I just love that a character that... I just love that it's not Sam.
Yeah.
I love that it's not Sam, and it's not Lee, and it's not Max bookending this thing. It's
kind of her story in a lot of ways.
It's kind of her story in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Go Juliet.
Good stuff, man. Go Juliet.
Man,
thanks for doing this, and thanks for wedging this in. I know we had a hard time with the scheduling, but
don't worry about it.
As fun as I hoped it would be. Great movie.
It's a great movie, and I really love talking
I hear that
to
baby.
About that shit. Oh, yeah.
Go be a dad.
Oh, yeah. I got to go be a dad. But I'll tell you one thing. It's really great to rewatch these things with Movie Crush in mind because Movie Crush makes these things, makes me see them in a really brand new, kind of more analytical way, and I love it.
It's fun. I'm glad you're enjoying it too, my friend.
I am, buddy.
All right. See you later.
All right. I'm going to go move to Cape Fear literally in about a month.
Awesome.
All right.
All right. Thanks, dude.
See you, man.
Movie Crush is produced and written by Charles Bryant and Noel Brown, edited and engineered by Seth Nicholas Johnson, and scored by Noel Brown here in our home studio at Ponce de Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.